and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the Markets team.
This week on the show, the Fed cut rates for the third straight time, but they signaled that's all for now. Plus, some of the biggest tech names reported earnings. Our guests will help us break it all down.
And as always, we'll close out the episode with the craziest things we saw in markets this week. Sarah, a week or two ago was awkward where you and I both picked the same crazy thing.
Was it awkward? I thought it was actually pretty great.
I'm going to tell you, I guarantee you did not pick the same one as me this week. And I'll tell you why. It involves a very nerdy hobby I've gotten into lately.
You never know.
Very nerdy.
I'm just saying, you never know.
Not the nerdiest hobby, I'll tell you that. I was telling a friend about it. I said, I've just gotten sucked into the nerdiest hobby of all time. And he goes, oh, are you grinding your own telescope lenses?
Oh, okay.
And I was like, excuse me? It was so nerdy, I was offended, but oddly intrigued. So I might start grinding my own telescope lenses as well. It's a thing, apparently.
All right, well, we'll be excited to hear it. And remember, we have our very own Bloomberg podcast hotline. So if you guys want to share your crazy market statistics or whatever it may be with us, give us a call, leave us a message at 646-324-3490. And we may even play it on the show.
And of course, our guests this week hopefully have some crazy things they brought along with us. First time on the show, joining us is Lauren Goodwin. She's an economist and multi-asset portfolio strategist at New York Life Investments. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm not going to put you on the spot, but if you do have any really nerdy hobbies, you know, feel free to share them with us.
Perfect.
Right? Anything?
Nothing. I love watching monetary policy meetings. Does that count?
That's pretty nerdy.
We're all nerds.
That is pretty
nerdy.
We're all nerds. And also returning to the show is Bloomberg Opinion Technology columnist Shira Ovadai. Shira, I think your nerdiest hobby is just reading 10K reports.
Yeah, that's
fine companies.
That's not nerdy at all, though, right?
I think that's pretty normal for Bloomberg.
Yeah, right. That's kind of the run of the mill hobby. But Lauren, let's start with you. I was reading some of the notes you sent over, and one thing popped out at me immediately. You say there's a chance U.S. yields could move into negative territory. That is shocking. Not entirely shocking. I guess it's, of all the crazy things we've seen in markets this year, that probably would not be that crazy. But what it intrigued me is you also said you think the Fed is done after this last rate cut. So what would take U.S. yields negative if not the Fed sort of helping to push them down?
Well, the Fed's done for now. They're not done for forever, but we can talk about that later. I'll answer your question about yields, which is two major things go into U.S. yields. One of them is expectations for the Fed funds rate, which could go to zero or would go to zero if we're if we move into recession in the U.S. The other thing is the term premium. So that's just what investors expect to get for taking the risk of holding a bond over cash or any other cash-like instrument. So what makes term premiums zero or even negative, as they've been in the U.S. even this year, are things like investor fears, some of the concerns that we've seen about global growth, trade wars, et cetera. And so if you see the U.S. inch a little bit closer to recession and some of these fears take hold, add it together, you can easily see U.S. negative yields. Doesn't mean necessarily a negative 10-year yield. I also think that the bar for the Fed moving policy rates negative is high. That's a completely different issue, but yields on the short end, totally possible.
And that's intriguing to me because of this so much supply to fund the deficit. We're looking at potentially another $1 trillion deficit in every foreseeable year. A lot of that on the short end. But you think, would it sort of be that rush to cash, money market mutual fund type of situation that really crush the short end?
Yeah, you know, you can't get positive yield anywhere in safe assets. And so it's really a there is no alternative type of story. When you have, as we do right now, Japanese insurance companies willing to move into investment grade, which is credit, even if it's investment grade credit, instead of being in these super safe government securities, then moving into U.S. super safe securities makes a lot of sense. That can totally squeeze the front end.
Let's back up the truck a little bit. So before we were to potentially get to negative interest rates, you would imagine that the data would have to worsen. Maybe the Fed would go back to cutting once again. But for now, like you said, the Fed is on hold. However, the market is still pricing in rate cuts as soon as next year. What is it that gets us to that point? What brings that disconnect closer together?
I think it makes sense that the market is pricing in cuts next year. Mm-hmm. We're on the last legs of this expansion. The Fed has bought us time. Some of the sort of risk on behavior, some of the risks that we've seen becoming less pronounced also helps buy us a little bit of time. In investor world, it helps us rebalance our portfolios. But we're looking at an economic cycle and specifically a company profit cycle that is just moving closer to recession. And so while we're not calling for recession in the next 12 months, in the 12 to 18 time period, that's absolutely a likely scenario from my perspective. And so the Fed's on pause for now, saying, look, until we see that data deteriorate further, we're fine. They also have seen over the course of the year, even before they actually started cutting rates, some improvement in interest rates sensitive indicators, just because folks expected it to come. Wait and see. But once we see the debt burdens that companies are facing start to take hold and those profit margins really start to see the pressure that they've been under for the past couple of years, then you start to see the Fed getting worried again.
So safe to describe you as not exactly bullish these days.
That is correct. But I will say, strategically speaking, we're defensive in our portfolios. So we invest for the long term. Most of our investors are thinking about retirement, or institutional clients really thinking in terms of years, not months. So strategically speaking, we've moved more defensive.
I'm glad you brought that up. You read my mind. I was going to ask you about that. You said, you know, contrary to market moves, we're holding tight on our defensive portfolio positioning. This is a really fascinating topic to me because I've heard a lot of people say this, but I'd like to unpack it a little bit, what you mean by defensive. And the reason I bring it up, I was fascinated. I looked this week at the Invesco defensive ETF, which has really done well this year. It's up 25%, you know, better than the S&P itself. And I was thinking, well, when I think defensive, I think, okay, you're going to buy Johnson & Johnson. You're going to buy utilities. You're going to buy those sort of safe consumer staples. This ETF is fascinating because, okay, healthcare is 10%. That's kind of classic defensive there. But of its other allocations, more than 5% is allocated to software, more than 5% to electronics, more than 5% to diversified financials, and more than 5% to banks. So more than 10% of this quote unquote defensive ETF is financial firms, which kind of blows my mind. So that's all a long setup to just kind of help us unpack what you mean by defensive. In the stock market, obviously, but also outside of the stock market, you know, where sort of in the treasury curve would you be looking at that sort of thing?
Oh, great. You set up an A and B for me. That's
A
perfect.
And B, right?
So
in equities, defensive means, and this is a story that's gotten a lot of airtime, frankly, it means high quality companies that are making consistent earnings and they're consistently giving those earnings back to shareholders. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean only yield, because there can be dividend yield traps, but really security by security, not even necessarily sector by sector, identifying the companies that are going to return that value back to shareholders. From an investor perspective, when you're expecting a more volatile environment, that's safer. When you move outside of the equity markets, defensive strategies generally include moving up in quality, but where you've seen a big shift in move up in quality, like in high yield, for example, you also have to go shorter duration. And so those are the general types of securities. Again, when you're expecting a lot of investor uncertainty, when you're near the end of the profit cycle and you have high debt loads within companies, you just have to be really secure.
So it's more what companies have the balance sheet to withstand a recession rather than what companies are in industries that tend not to be crushed by recession.
Precisely. And which companies are going to pay you cash in the meantime, even within equities, right? It's not just fixed income, but where can you get a little bit of carry while you hold those equities if, for example, you don't think recession is right around the corner?
So bear with me then. Are we almost seeing a divergence in the stock market? Because as you mentioned, you guys are sticking with your defensive positioning, that counter to almost what we've been seeing over the past couple of weeks, where we've started to see cyclicals outperforming, those classic bond proxies like staples, like utilities, like real estate underperforming. But at the same time, it does seem as though all of a sudden investors really care about corporate profits. So investors do care about quality to a sense. Do the two go counter to one another, or do they actually fit together?
Well, we're in this part of the cycle that's really uncomfortable when the data is mixed. And so if you had a different guest on in 10 minutes, they could say the exact opposite of what I'm saying. And I would think that they were reasonable. What we're seeing is we're late in the cycle. We've already had two mid-cycle slowdowns. And so not only are the structural elements of the economy, we've talked about debt loads and profit margins, not only are those creeping closer and closer to recession-like qualities, but also from a higher position than we've been in the other two mid-cycle slowdowns. And equity prices have moved higher all along. And so you can see as an investor short-term cyclical opportunities. So for example, risk has been such a factor in the markets across the board this year and last year. When you get a little bit of that risk premium pulled off because there's positive rumors about a trade deal, for example, you can have a short-term cyclical opportunity. And so it's not necessarily bifurcating. You're just playing sort of a long game, short game. And so what we do, for example, when we're making these more defensive shifts is as we've moved up in quality gets expensive. So when you start taking off a little bit of high beta exposure at market highs, for example, or in asset classes that we don't like as much, like high yield or bank loans, you can use that cash to take advantage of those short-term cyclical opportunities without completely abandoning your long-term story, which is where we're positioned right now.
Well, sure. Let's bring you in here and switch gears from defensives to companies that are perhaps offensive for various reasons. And I'm thinking of the Facebooks, the Alphabets, the Twitters. We had a whole lot of quote unquote FANG type of companies report over the last week or so. Are there any sort of common themes, common takeaways from the whole sort of communications and tech sector earnings season?
I mean, it's a little bit hard to draw generalities about the tech sector in general, because I think the big tech companies that you mentioned, the sort of FANGs or FAMGs, whatever people call them, Facebook, FAMG, which includes Microsoft.
I think that's the right pronunciation.
FAMG. So those large five or six technology companies seem to be doing very well, that growth for the most part has continued at a pretty good rate, albeit it's come down for many of those companies. Again, the profit margins have come down, but it's all relative, right? So Facebook this week reported earnings. They are spending a lot more money. The growth rates have come down, but we're still talking about 30% growth year over year, and their operating profit margins are about 40%. So if you're talking about, you know, defensive kind of companies, those giant tech companies start to look a little bit more safe, I guess. But on the other hand, you have these younger companies that are valued almost entirely on their growth rates. And there it's a little bit of a mixed bag. So again, we had Grubhub this week that did absolutely terrible. And to me, the scary thing about what Grubhub said was they feel like the promise of that industry of kind of food delivery, the on-demand, you push a button on an app and get anything delivered to your home at almost no cost, that they really think that that string is playing out, that there is no way economically that there can be multiple companies fighting each other to get something to your house as fast and cheap as they possibly can. And at the same time, they feel like the hypergrowth phase of that industry is pretty much over, which is kind of a scary 1-2 punch.
Is it a war of attrition at this point in that space?
I mean, that's what Grubhub thinks. And yeah, Look, they're not wrong that in the United States, I'll leave the overseas market out of this, but in the United States, you have a number of companies that are all chasing the same restaurants, the same diners, right? Uber Eats, Grubhub, DoorDash, Postmates. You can go on down the list. And so, yeah, there is a little bit of a war of attrition going on.
Lauren, I want to touch on something that Shira said, and that's that somehow these big tech companies start to look safer. Is this something that comes up in discussion with you and your team? I mean, I can say I've heard many investors say to me this year, oh, well, now tech is defensive.
It makes a lot of sense to me if you think even just in traditional economic terms to say that the model of not only economic growth, but also company growth and sustainable growth has changed from, you know, when we were more industrial or manufacturing focused, for example. So when we were a year ago, we were really holding out on productivity in the U.S., that this would be what saved the economic cycle, and that we'd see investment translate into productivity. We haven't seen that. But the main sort of core tenet of that argument, I think, is absolutely still true, which is that these big tech companies are the only ones investing in themselves. And so an interesting thing to think about is, what is the next step? What is the investment strategy of the future look like? And something I think is really compelling there is companies that are investing not through CapEx or some of these indicators that we're used to looking at, but OpEx. What are the logistics companies that are investing in, you know, next generation software to make sure that these supply chains disruptions with China or Europe are not an issue for their profits? That's really interesting. That's a really interesting type of sort of secure, safe investment. I think that this growth versus value, cyclical versus defensive sort of general named indices are starting to break down. So I completely agree with Shira.
And just to say something a little bit scary, though, I will just point out that of the giant tech companies that now seem a little bit safe, almost without exception, and Microsoft is the exception, those companies haven't really lived through a recession, at least not in their kind of current giant company status. So I don't think we really know what Amazon looks like, for example, in a recessionary period. And again, obviously they were around in 2009, 2010, but they were a significantly smaller company, less sprawling. E-commerce was kind of a significantly smaller share of U.S. spending. So I do not know what happens, even to the biggest, safest, most profitable giant tech companies in a recessionary environment.
Well, and you add the one more giant spooky element in the room, which is the potential for regulation. And so when we're talking about these specific big tech companies, the risks are pronounced when it comes to this isn't just a political issue. This is a substantial structural issue around inequality and data protection and really big questions that I think are here to stay. And so when we talk about these specific companies, there are surely risks in the coming years. When you're looking, though, at an investment, that's a compelling story.
Lauren, I think you stole my notes, because I was that was my next segue. And I was going to give a gratuitous plug to a story that Sarah worked on this week about, it's kind of becoming the big buzzy zeitgeist on Wall Street now, is the specter of possible Elizabeth Warren presidency.
For a second, I was like, which story are you talking about, Mike? Now I know.
You remember you worked on that, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's been a long week.
You didn't just sneak your name on that.
It's been a long week.
But I wrote about it, too, to give another gratuitous plug a couple weeks ago. But obviously, Elizabeth Warren has everyone on Wall Street freaked out, and many people predicting this big bear market if she should sort of ascend in the polls any further. Cheryl, let's start with you, though. I'm curious if her name came up at all on any of the conference calls or any of the analyst notes. And part B, since if you guys will both accept A and B questions, part B, I'm just curious, how would you go about breaking up, say, a Facebook, an Alphabet, and an Amazon? And would that necessarily be a negative for shareholders in this company? You know, I'm thinking, wouldn't the S&P be better off if it had a Google and a YouTube and an Instagram and an Amazon Cloud and an Amazon Retail? I mean, you're talking about a lot of sort of interesting businesses that would suddenly be their own companies. What's the thinking on this from your world?
Okay, so now I have to do A and B. A, yes, I think the regulation obviously is now, I think, a regular part of reality for these companies. The sort of difficult thing, I think, both for the companies and for investors, honestly, is just it's impossible to know how this plays out and how long it takes, right? You're talking about a federal and state now antitrust investigations involving basically all the giant tech companies, with the exception of Microsoft. And what if it takes 10 years? I don't know. I don't know what happens. So it's one of these kind of storm clouds, but it's unclear exactly how it ends or how exactly to play for it.
Am I the only one who finds it funny that Microsoft is the one they're not talking about?
Yes, it is extremely. I think if you had told like 2010 Shira that there would be antitrust investigations and Microsoft would be completely uninvolved, that they look like the white hats and all this, it would seem preposterous.
Flying under the radar.
There we have it.
But back to Part B, about breaking these companies
up. Your point
up.
About Part B. I definitely have seen the sell-side analysts talking about, you know, we think Facebook would be more valuable or Google would be more valuable if it were split in pieces. I think that is nuts. I can go company by company, but if you think about a company like Facebook, and I think the Elizabeth Warren types who were talking about Facebook and antitrust, what they're talking about largely is pulling out the companies that Facebook acquired in the last 10 years. So that's primarily Instagram and WhatsApp. And to say that Facebook is more valuable if you pull out those two companies is just bad. It is wrong. That particularly on the usage side, right, Instagram is the growth story for Facebook right now. It's important with younger people. It's important with advertisers who want to reach younger people. And WhatsApp is also an important element of Facebook's growth outside of North America, in countries like India, like the Middle East, where WhatsApp is extremely popular. And look, Facebook hasn't successfully figured out how to make money from WhatsApp, but that's an asset that has and we don't know exactly how many, but more than 1 billion users worldwide. And that is extremely valuable to Facebook. And that's an extremely important part of the investment thesis for Facebook.
Lauren, what about your guys' take, not on just the regulatory aspect and the risks that poses, not even just to the tech companies, but the market at large, but also just everything going on in politics right now, whether it is impeachment proceedings or looking forwards to the 2020 election, when you have the likes of Paul Tudor Jones, for example, this past week coming out and saying if Elizabeth Warren wins, the S&P will drop 25%. I mean, how can you even go about making predictions like this or trying to at least take these ideas and inform your investments?
I'll make a shameless plug for myself in that we...
We allow shameless plugs here.
Wrote a piece on political and geopolitical risk and portfolio management and found that not only do investors, and again, I'm thinking investors for the medium or longer term, tend not to pay very close attention, but probably shouldn't. Maybe we get a 20-25% sell-off if Elizabeth Warren gets the nomination or wins the election. We thought the same thing about Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't know, but and maybe we do. But the really what this is about is looking past politics and towards policy. And when it comes to the pace and likelihood that some of these suggestions would be implemented, we know it's really challenging. To Shira's point, maybe it takes 10 years. And so we have the enormous luxury of keeping a pulse on things, but not letting it impact our portfolio management decisions until that policy, again, not politics, but policy change, actually should impact our portfolio. So in that sense, trade even a year and a half ago flipped into our radar as something that we need to monitor on an ongoing basis because it threatened companies and it threatened the consumer. Right now, the political situation, whether it's the election or impeachment, et cetera, in the U.S. doesn't impact companies. And so we treat it as such.
All right. Well, I think it's that time.
I'm really excited for yours, Mike. I want to know what new nerdy thing you're interested in.
New nerdy thing. All right. Well, let's save mine for last.
Okay.
I want to build up the suspense. Sure, let's start with you. I think you brought a crazy thing along, didn't you?
Well, I was very surprised this week that there were news stories about Apple making a pretty significant change in its strategy to one of its important products. So it emerged this week that Apple is tiptoeing in what's been called kind of a bundling strategy for its internet services, that at least for students, it's going to offer for $5 a month, students can have a subscription to both Apple Music and to Apple's upcoming TV Plus service, which is its kind of its answer to Netflix, a kind of web video entertainment service. And the way that this came out was not, you know, Apple reported earnings and they announced this, or Tim Cook went on TV to talk about it with Sarah. No, Hailee Steinfeld, who's an actress and singer, she put it in an Instagram story that this was going to be a new policy change or at least an experiment.
And that was Apple the that was that the is, first word of this?
That was the first word of this.
This is the world we live in now.
Yes. She is she's in Dickinson. She plays Emily Dickinson in one of Apple's upcoming television series. So I guess that's why she was chosen to make this announcement. But
God,
yes.
As a strategist, who do I need to follow these days to know what our investment strategy should be?
You mean investors don't just automatically get alerts for Hailee Steinfeld's Instagram stories?
She had a big hit on the radio. It wasn't Call Me Maybe, was it?
No. She is a singer. She was in a couple of the Pitch Perfect movies.
That's right.
She was in Pitch Perfect.
Yeah, she was in Bumblebee, the Transformers movie that no one saw.
All right.
In the United States.
That's pretty good. You're in the lead so far.
Okay.
But
well, I'm the only
I'm thinking
one.
Lauren,
the only
maybe one Lauren can gone. Knock you out of the lead. Okay.
So I have two. One is boring but real. Which
overachiever.
Is that, well, it is crazy to me, and this is, again, a little bit of a plug for our perspective, but it is crazy to me that recession probabilities are reaching new cycle highs and we have equity markets at all-time highs. I think that's crazy. But I brought a fun one because the point is not to be realistic. In the New York Life Investments world, the craziest conversation that happened this week is that New York banned foie gras. And we have a lot of conversations. One of our portfolio managers is vegan and one is a very enthusiastic meat eater. And so the conversation around alternative food companies is robust. And so when we saw this policy change, we lamented some of the fancy New York French restaurants, but also the potential for more alternative food companies on the back of this,
Beyond
this major
foie gras,
change.
Maybe?
I will say it's been a rough week for Beyond Foie Gras.
Absolutely.
Do you want to call them that?
I'm curious what your actuaries say about that. You know, is that going to elongate people's lives if they eat less foie gras? You can get back to us.
Do we know the reasoning behind the law change? I'm just curious.
It's not very nice to geese.
Yeah.
Is I think
that's
the...
So sad.
That's funny. This is our second craziest thing involving mistreating geese. We had the Canadian Goose Company. Apparently they were beating their geese to get the feathers off them.
There's always protesters in front of that store.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Always.
It's hard to be a goose, I guess.
Yes.
All right, Sarah, I'm less confident that I'm going to win this week's craziest thing, but what do you have? Maybe you can top these guys.
I don't think you really have to worry about mine. So like I said, I had a long week. So what did I do to find my craziest thing? I went to find some pharmaceutical company that had a really great showing. So this company called Iveric Bio, granted, even after the jump we saw this week, it's only worth like $3 or something of that sort a share. But still, they had one of their main trials, meet its primary endpoint. Big deal for the company. And not only did we see the stock move 82% on Monday, then we saw another roughly 30% jump on Tuesday and a 65% jump on Wednesday. So pretty crazy. The stock is up somewhere around 250% this week. But then again, $3 a share. So
biopharma is a great place to go looking for crazy.
It really
crazy
is.
All right, I'll give you mine and my which involves my nerdiest hobby. I don't know if a lot of listeners realize, but at Bloomberg, we obviously talk a lot about stocks. We don't do a lot of trading of stocks because of various rules. You know, if I could talk about any stock, given stock on any given day, I shouldn't really be investing in that stock, obviously. But the rules do not prevent me from speculating in another market, and that, Shira, is the market for vintage bicycles. And this was apparently a very hipster thing to do, like in Brooklyn about a decade ago. So I'm right on time. This is my normal timing here to get involved in this.
Decade late.
It's a very, let's say price discovery is very difficult in this market because everyone thinks their old bike is worth a fortune. So you'll see people put up an old bike for $500 and, you know, it sells for $100. So I found these beautiful Schwinn cruisers that I thought were from the 60s or so on Facebook Marketplace, that's the main venue for vintage bike nerds like myself. And the guy wanted like $200 for the pair of them. And these things might be worth something if you scrub them up and you got the rust off and everything. But in the condition they were in, I was like, no way. I said, sight unseen, I'll give you $75 for them. And we started haggling back and forth. Eventually, I said, look, I'll come and see them. If I think they're worth more than $75, I'll give it to you.
So I get there and I'm like, tell you what, I'll give you $100 for two of them. Okay. And he goes, that's fair. And I said, that's fair, right? So $50 a piece, I got these two bikes. I went home and I looked them up. 1963 Schwinn's coaster brakes. As a friend of mine said, the one looks like Pee Wee Herman's bike from Pee Wee's Big Adventure. But Sarah, this is all leading up to the... This is all leading up to the crazy part. Now, remember, I spent $50 a piece on these bikes.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you a page of the catalog from the 1963 Schwinn Company, and look at the circled number and read how much that bike cost in 1963.
Wow, good deal. $49.95.
$49.95, and I paid $50 for it. So I believe I've discovered the ultimate store of value here is a 1963 Schwinn.
Inflation is dead.
Yes.
Right.
It's pretty unbelievable.
Exactly. Talk about an efficient market.
Yeah, you win for narrative value for sure.
All right, I'll accept that.
And
I win.
And you got two bikes out of it.
That is a beautiful bike. Look at that. Come on.
Can you ride it without dying? Does it actually function?
Not yet. Okay. Yeah.
You're welcome in Brooklyn anytime.
As long as it's safe.
It takes us a while in Jersey to get the trends that you guys have in Brooklyn. So,
well, now you've made it. Even if it's a decade late, it's worth it. Same price. So. But anyways, Lauren Goodwin, Shira Ovide, thank you so much for joining us today. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. Our guest, Lauren Goodwin, is at L.E. Goodwin, and Shira Ovide is at Shira Ovide. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.